We're back, folks. Welcome to episode 17 of the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. On today's show, we have Tom Butters, the Director of Education of the Illuminating Engineering Society. That's right. Came on the show to tell us about all the great educational products that the IES is putting out. They got a bunch of stuff. Go to ies.org. In this conversation, man, it went everywhere. We talked about the IES. We talked about the DLC. We talked about lighting, the lighting business, the crazy, crazy lighting business. So I'm not going to tell you much more about Tom Butters. He spoke for himself on the show, actually. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Sign Hero. Come on, man. Keystone Technologies, KeystoneTech.com. Or just Google Keystone Sign Hero, man. Come right up. That's right. What do you want Sign Hero for? Well, ain't much left out there, man. Lots of people have already converted to LED, but you can still go after the signs, man. All those pylon signs, the box signs, all that kind of stuff. All you do, you cut all the wires on one side of the sign, all the wires to the other sockets on the other side of the sign. You tie them in, one to the line voltage, one to the neutral, and slam in those Keystone Sign Hero T12 and T8HO sign tube replacements, man. Come on, buddy. Rotatable sockets, 360 degree illumination and 50,000 hours of life. Man, you just retrofitted that sign. 50% energy savings. Go to KeystoneTech.com. KeystoneTech.com, baby. And don't forget, we are the official podcast of the lighting business, in my opinion. But for sure, we're the official podcast of the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Go to NAILD.org. That's nailed.org. You can join even if you don't have a warehouse now. That's right. You don't even need to be a distributor. You can be associate member. We've lowered the price. We've got the best educational products. Well, the IES may argue with us a little bit, but we like LS1, LS2, and LS controls. Come on, man. Get some education. Go on down to NAILD.org. Meet us at the convention. Come on, man. Episode 17 with Tom Butters of the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. Sign Hero. Welcome to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast, Tom.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Say hi to my co-host, Greg Eric.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
Good, Tom. How are you?
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about your role at the IES with the education.
I'm the Director of Education. I started in the fall of 2016. And generally, my job consists of three pillars. So I'm there to support the standards, so recommended practices, design guides, and that type of publication. The second pillar is to support the membership and the sections, specifically to give membership more value than it has previously. And the third is public outreach, is the third pillar, so to get out there, get my name out there, get the IES's name out there even more importantly. So this is a wonderful avenue for that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know what? A lot of people that most, you know, it's funny when we look at the subscribers that come in, Greg, when I look at them, I often search them up on LinkedIn after they come on, and it's always a sales rep or a marketing department person, Greg, isn't it? I don't know. Rarely do you get like
government relations or public relations kind of thing.
Yeah. So how much has lighting education changed in the last 5 years?
Oh my goodness. It's such a wonderful field to be in, because it's changing yearly the way it used to change by decade. And it's so fast paced now. The lighting industry for so long was just stagnant. This is the way we did it before, and this is the way it worked. And why change it, right? You don't change something if it's not broke. But the industry, specifically with the solid state lighting, the change has increased so drastically and frequently that the change of education had to follow suit. And I think we're behind on that, and we're playing massive catch up presently.
Well, I think that segues perfectly into what Greg wanted to talk about, or when we were discussing it. Greg, why don't you take it from here for a bit?
Yeah, I've got a few things. First of all, just on IES, I'm a member, so I should maybe know this, but who runs IES? How does a governance body, how does it work?
Well, the IES is ostensibly run by its members, and we have a board of directors that are voted on by the membership at large. They're ultimately in charge. As far as the day-to-day goings on at the IES, Tim Lesitra is the executive director. and he's the top of the
Is he an employee?
Yes, he is an
Okay.
employee. So he's responsible for all the other employees, including myself.
Okay.
How many employees are there?
There's about, I don't know the exact number, so you'll have to forgive me, but I think somewhere in the
No, that's fine.
vicinity of 22, 24.
Sure. Okay.
Now we had Randy Reed on, and it was really our breakthrough podcast for Get a Grip on Lighting, wouldn't you say, Greg? Randy and then Tina Halfpenny were the two that really we went from, kind of a niche thing and shot up to be, I think, the lighting industry's podcast, if I do say so myself.
Great.
But he had expressed, and I think Mark Lean as well had expressed that the IES has lost some ground to other organizations within the lighting industry in terms of authority. First of all, I guess, would you agree with that statement? And two, what are you guys doing, if you agree, what are you doing to kind of recover that lost ground or that ceded space?
Well, I most certainly agree. That's basically how I got my job, by saying how we've lost ground entirely to other organizations. So the key is, I mean, we can do all we want and want the IES to be relevant, but we need content in order to be relevant. We can't say, hey, we're the IES. Don't you remember us? We're the Illuminating Engineering Society. We've been around for over 100 years. We should be valued. So we're trying to build the content of what we can give to members and what we can give to the general public and the industry at large. And once we have that content, those programs, the standards in place, and they're functioning incredibly quickly with the industry, then I think our name will begin to take over the way, in my opinion, it should be.
Now, on that subject of the three pillars, standards is one of them, and that's what you just mentioned.
Correct.
To me, the standard in lighting now has been DLC, or at least that's what it looks like from the outside.
I agree with you
And
entirely, and that's from a manufacturing perspective. So the materials, the IES is more involved with the application, the use of the materials, guidelines. A lot of energy codes are derived from the guidelines that our standards committees put together.
But in terms of pure influence, I think the IES is. And you know what's interesting? I don't know when or which podcast it was that I brought it up, but traditional lighting people were slow to adopt LED technology, which is, I think, part of the reason why the IES was slow. So for when you back in 2009, I wasn't selling, I don't think, any LED bulbs. To that, maybe in 2012, maybe it was 5% of total bulbs shipped or whatever. I think most traditional lighting guys and organizations like the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors and the IES were toeing the water. But other people that were new entrants to the business were running full steam into that space. And so it wasn't that, maybe it wasn't that they ceded ground, it's that it opened up and other people moved in.
Well, the nature abhors a vacuum, and I think there was a we left the vacuum when solid state lighting started. And solid state lighting has been around for far longer than that. It's only during that time when the products became functional, like functional in an acceptable manner. And that happened relative, like very quickly. From a lighting perspective, it happened in milliseconds type thing. And in my opinion, we, the IES, didn't move as quickly as we needed to. Didn't even realize that the vacuum was forming, and therefore these other groups that have come on, and they fill the place that was required in the industry. So, and regardless of if you say, Greg, that you think the DLC, I mean, well, that's wonderful. I don't have anything bad to say about any of these organizations, because they filled a role, and
No,
we can
we're
fill
not
that role
against any.
too.
We're not against anybody. We're
Yeah.
not. It's not like
Well, you
we.
sound like you're against the IES. I mean, like,
No, we're being critical. No,
a
but
joke.
you.
I'm totally joking.
No,
I'm
no,
sorry.
no. No, you know, it's fair. It's a fair comment, because I've criticized. Greg has criticized the IES. He's an LC. He's a lighting dork. I'm not. Okay. So, but from the, like, just looking on the outside, if you think about, I had a great question in my head there, but if you think about, I don't know how to put it, it's almost like
you know, traditional lighting people did not want to, did not, I mean, in 2014, Greg and I were at a National Association of Innovative Lighting convention, and, you know, LCs were talking about, I don't need T8 LED tubes. I can do the same thing with a four lamp, low power, low ballast factor ballast and four T8s. Remember that?
I do. From, yeah.
Yeah. Well, from an energy perspective, that's true.
They were almost against the mass adoption of LED technology in many ways.
I understand. And I think you have to be very careful. And I think we're in a time in the industry now where we're a little better. If we put an LED T8 tube into a product that's designed to have an omnidirectional light source in it, the light that's coming out of that, the distribution that's coming out of that luminaire will be different than what's intended. Now, if you're just going around looking at light levels on the horizontal plane, then your LED products will provide much better efficacy than an omnidirectional fluorescent. But if you're looking all around on the ambient, then it may not. However, that being said, the T8 LEDs now give you more of an omnidirectional source. Mm. So that when they first came out, they were very directional. Mm. You had very tight beams. So yes, my efficacy is excellent, but it's only in that beam pattern. And I don't have the vertical illuminance that I may require in my space.
And the other thing too, is I thought a lot of the luminaires looked dark. So
that's basically the reason, because there's no light up above.
And I think that when you have an office full of 2x4 foot troffers, say, mm-hmm. and you would put those 180 degree directional LED tubes in it, you would see that there was dark around the tubes, and you could see these lines of light in the fixture. I don't think it looked good at all. But how many people actually care about that, Greg, Eric?
Yeah, that's a good point. And one of the things I want to ask you, Tom, and I'm going to probably ask this on just about every person I talk to on this podcast, because it's something I think about all the time. But in the future, you know, we're talking about T8 LED lamps right now. And you've kind of indicated that, you know, those fixtures aren't always necessarily meant for that type of light source, even though they are more omnidirectional. Where do you see it heading? Do you think it'll continue to be, let's replace this fluorescent fixture, keep retrofitting it, and keep putting LEDs in it? Or at some point, do we just got to start over and put new fixtures in?
Oh, what a great question that is. The whole draw to LED is the efficaciousness of the system. So the total lumens per watt that are being delivered. The reason why linear fluorescent is so slow to adopt is not only the cost, but the linear fluorescent is, you know, what is it, $3 or something along the line?
Those are Canadian dollars too.
So. Yeah, Canadian dollars. So that's 50 cents US.
Yeah. Canadian pesos. Yeah.
So that's difficult. And fluorescent on it in itself is highly efficacious anyways. That being said, I don't know of any manufacturers that are doing any type of research in very many many other avenues except for solid state lighting.
So, no, what he's saying is, what you're asked, Greg, if I remember, is when do we start ripping out fixtures?
Right.
Like we've been slamming. First, we put up the, you know, took out the halides. We put in six lamp, eight lamp, T8, T5s. Now we're putting, you know, the LED tubes in. I think the customer decides that, Greg. I don't think the lighting industry does.
Well, they do, but I think at some point we're going to, or we're maybe going to have the power to do that. And that's what I'm just kind of, trying to figure out.
Yeah, there's no doubt. It is coming. If you're going to ask me when, I've been notoriously incorrect in predicting how LEDs are going to be adopted.
So you and pretty much everybody else, yeah. I think.
So I would be shocked that in the next few years, let's say five or so, that there'll be more just total luminaires. People will be ripping out those luminaires, except for these wonderful indirect products that we have.
You know, those were just a couple four lamp T8 fixtures I had in my warehouse that I threw some T8 LED tubes into and flipped them over. But you know what's interesting? You can actually, did you listen to our podcast with Dr. Arnold Wilkins?
No, I missed that.
Oh, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. So he was talking about temporal modulation. you can actually see in the video, and I'm not going to ask Scott to call it up on the screen because we've had some a little bit of technical issues to getting set up here, but you can actually see them flicking in the window on the video off and on. And it's so
magnetic ballast?
No, there's no ballast in it. It's it's a direct line. It's a bypass LED tube in there. But it's actually, you know, 60 hertz.
Right,
so to our visual, like right here, we can't see it blinking, but through the camera, you can see it flicking on and off.
Yeah, your peripheral vision is more sensitive to
for
it.
Sure.
So if you want to get rid of it, just look at it straight.
Yeah, there you go.
And then it's gone.
So what have you guys done in the training avenue? What have you guys done to really provide training to the public, the non-IES members, and also your own members?
Oh, thank you very much for that question. I appreciate that. We're working on developing new programs. We have we started in June 2017 to have a monthly webinar series. Our first webinar series had 87 attendees, which we thought was okay. It's a nice start. However, within 3 months, we have over 1,000 people registered for each and every one of our seminars, our webinars rather. They're presently free.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting an incredible, because they're free, you have the drawback that you register, but you don't get everybody who registers to attend.
Mm-hmm.
So we're charting now at about 52% of registers to attend, and that's excellent for a free webinar. These webinars then are recorded, and we have them on our website. This is a member.
What is your website?
www.ies.org.
Okay.
And these webinars are available to our members. It's a member benefit, so we have them all cataloged and up on our website. And that's just one of our programs. We have a number of other programs. I can get into them as much
as
you wish.
Yeah, talk about it. Yeah, sure, talk about them.
The one I'd really like to discuss is something called the Indispensable Lighting Series. So these are professionally filmed videos. They were at least an hour long, and they're available to anybody on our website. Again, www.ies.org. How am I doing with the promotion?
You're doing good, man. Just keep shamelessly promoting that ies.org. ies.org.
I will do that, and I will still have a job.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So the Indispensable Lighting Series, we have four parts now, two different series. The first one is Architecture for Light, and it's a two-part series with Kim and Paul Mercier, based on their book Architecture for Light, and it is a must for anybody who wants to be a lighting designer, architect. Just absolutely fabulous, very accessible.
Mm.
The second part is the second series is called Lights of the Round. You guys can't steal that now. We have that.
Yeah, that's right. It's up there with the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast.
Yeah,
anyway,
exactly. Anyway, so and what that is, and we just released it in January, and it is the players in the lighting design process and specification process.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a round table of an architect, designer, engineer, someone representing distributors and manufacturers, mm-hmm. And lighting control specialist. And they are asked a number of questions, and more or less it's an open conversation on how they work together.
Are these people that work in the field?
They are, yes. As a matter of fact, the individual representing distributors and manufacturers is the CEO of Electrofit, Carol McGlogan.
Hmm. Okay, there you go. That's Canada's Canada's like kind of like NED Electrofit.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. All together in one.
Yeah,
we have fat.
And is that discussion primarily focused on new construction or starting in the new space?
It's pretty much anything about how they all play together of the questions. I mean, what you don't see is I'm producing it, directing it, sort of thing. I'm in the background. I come in and I tell them what the question is, and they paraphrase it, and out it comes. I mean, one of the questions I always like to bring up as an example is, a lot of people think that a distributor is just a banker in the lighting design process, and so they discuss that. And I think Carol gives a lot of wonderful reasons why that's just not so.
So as a former board member of the Lighting Distributors Organization in the United States, and as the former president here, I'll tell you, there's different kinds of distributors.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Absolutely. You know, there's just, there's some that are really into, you know, are almost like lighting designers. Mm-hmm. They're basically lighting design. They used to be distributor, order desk and counter sales, and they've sort of changed their business. And there's ones that are more like Greg and I, which are kind of more on the practical contracting side of it. The implementation of energy efficient lighting systems. But before I get to my next question, what's your background in lighting?
Well, it's a varied background.
You ever sell light bulbs to anybody?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We call them lamps, but yes. Yeah. years ago I had a degree in film production, and I was asked to go off for 6 months and film. However, I was living on my own at the time. I was young, I was living on my own. And I didn't want to take, I wanted to take 6 months off to see if I wanted to be a starving artist, because you need to pay your dues in order to do that. I started working as an electrical apprentice. So I was an electrical apprentice. I've installed all of this and for about 2 years, 2.5 years. Had the utmost respect for people who do that, because I was so bad at it, it wasn't funny. Mm. I left there and worked for a manufacturer in Montreal in customer service. Then moved and worked for different distributors, manufacturers in Toronto. And then finally, in 1999, I was asked to work at Canlite's Lighting Concept Center. So it's an education facility. And in 2006, 2005, 6, I became the director of that.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you about lighting controls. And we've had Wendell Strong come on from Genesis Lighting, mm-hmm. talk about power over Ethernet lighting control, basically what is the ability to deeply control lighting. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about different types of access to fixtures through. When is this getting too complicated? When is it just better to have a sensor in a room that is not smart and it just turns lights off when you're not there and turns them on when you're there?
What a great question. I think in the words of Al Jolson, you ain't seen nothing yet.
We actually ended up, there's a story. It's a little bit off lighting. This is funny. We were in a hotel. We were at was it a board meeting or something for Nailed, Greg?
It was a Nailed board meeting. Yeah.
So, and at the hotel at the same time, there was the annual Al Jolson Society get together. Mm-hmm. And people were standing up and doing Al Jolson. So that's interesting. Yeah. Al Jolson's back. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. So when does it, when does it get too complicated? When is like, accessing lights on your phone, individual lights being accessible. When are we going too far here in the industry with this?
I think that's a personal, opinion on that. And
what's your opinion?
I don't need all the bells and whistles that my phone allows me to have, mm-hmm. but there are people that do. So in order for phones to be...
Well, when you say they do, do you mean that they want it, or do you mean that it's controlled better?
I think we can make do with the like what we're at now, but why make do? I personally see the lighting industry to become as personalized as your telephone, like as your cell phone, as your smartphone. All three of us here, I guarantee we have at least one cell phone, and I'd be willing to bet that there's five between us.
Do you consider a BlackBerry a smartphone?
Yeah, it's the original smartphone.
We invented it.
Canadians, we taught the world how to type with our thumbs.
There you go.
It's absolutely up to the individual. So how much is enough for me is going to be far less than how much is enough for everybody. Look at how we change the television. I thought it was wonderful. You gentlemen are far too young to remember, but when we went from having to click the channels manually to actually there was a little box, you got to push the button, and look at how great this is.
Yeah, you know what, I had a conversation years ago, and jump in here, Greg, whenever you want, but I had a conversation.
Yeah.
When years ago, the guy from it was either Cellini or Philips, and they were talking about making lighting a consumer product. And I just leaned back and I said, look, I sell light bulbs every day to people, lamps every day to people. And
I'm bilingual. Like I can go both ways.
You can get into the trenches with us.
Yeah,
but I mean, I just thought to myself, like, I don't think so, dude. I mean, people, maybe they're over. Like, do you really need to get alerts on your phone from your light bulb, Craig? Get in here on this one, buddy.
Yeah, I think you look at just society as a whole and what is everybody doing. We've all had, I'm trying to think of what to relate it to. A phone's a good example. Your clothes can be a good example. You know, you used to just get a shirt, or you used to get just underwear or just socks. Now you've got options. People want options. And I think that's the same with lighting, is that you want to have options. You want to have it customizable. I mean, you guys are all probably getting things that are customized to the way you like it. I know I do, because that's just the human nature, is to get it the way you want things. So if people want it, sure, do it. Do we need it? Maybe not. But what else?
I would say
that about a lot of things.
I would say the vast majority of spaces that should be controlled with lighting controls, the vast majority, can be controlled to 98% of the energy efficiency with dumb lighting controls.
I have no argument with that whatsoever.
And so the case for, you know, accessibility to lights is, you know, I don't know if there's a really big business case there other than this. And to me, you know, I know Greg disagrees with me. We've argued about it. I don't know if the end user consumer average person wants to be able to control the lights in their boardroom. Do you want to be able to control the lights in your boardroom from your phone, Greg? I mean, maybe it looks cool.
Yeah,
I don't know, man.
I do, because I'm in lighting. If I wasn't in lighting, I probably wouldn't care. But
yeah,
to have that capability is nice.
Is that because that you're aware of it? I mean, there's an awareness,
yes,
that has to come to it, and not everybody is aware of what we can do. I mean, if we go back to the phone analogy, like, I never use Siri. Like, why do I need to use Siri? I can do everything that I want to by myself. And other people will be sitting here going, are you nuts? Siri's the best.
But hang on, like, this is what I made the point about the guy from Sylvania or Phillips. Lighting is not a consumer product. That's the issue. So a TV is a consumer product. An iPhone is a consumer product. A Samsung Galaxy is a consumer product. The lighting in your space is an accessory to your life. It's a fundamental accessory. It might be and I've said it on this show, that artificial light is the greatest invention of all time. Okay, it's the greatest invention. It's most the fundamental productivity driver of human beings was, you know, fire and then candles and then light bulbs. The ability to see at night is the productivity driver. But it's an accessory. It's something that people take for granted, and I don't think they want to take it as a consumer product.
I don't know, Mike. I'm gonna just jump in there, because in one of the reasons we got you on here, Tom, was I read your article saying that we actually now have the public's attention, so let's leverage that and use it to sell LED lighting.
Not necessarily sell LED lighting. To educate the public was really my point. Yeah.
Okay, then I'll sell LED lighting.
You can sell LED lighting to educated consumers.
Well, I mean, so what does a consumer need to know? Okay, so for example, my customers rely on my contracting and product knowledge, mm-hmm, and I go around every day and I sell lighting systems to people. What does the average consumer need to know about LED lighting that they don't know right now, Tom?
Well, I mean, we're talking about now as opposed to in the future, and who knows what's going to happen in the future. What people need to know now is far different than what people needed to know 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. In 10 years ago, the variables of light production were very minimal. Mm-hmm. Now it's so huge, the vast differences in light production, in efficacy, in color, and not only just in color temperature, but we're talking about spectrum. We can go in and fine tune a light source now. Mm. Here's a 3200 Kelvin, but you know what? I don't like what it does to my blues, and I want a punch of blue. So we can fine tune with short wavelength, more short wavelength energy, and it'll punch out my blue. So that's not a 3200 Kelvin like we envision it normally. It's a personalized 3,200 Kelvin. And I can see that type of thing happening, even in commercial, when people are talking about doing their living room or their bedroom and they want a certain look. And all this light doesn't make my, I wanted that to look cream and it looks sort of green. So I need to change the spectral power distribution of this light source. And that's possible, like beginning to be possible now.
And that, Mike, I think that's why, is because you can do that with LED. Other light sources, you couldn't do it. It's just like your phone. Your phone was used to be able to call people. That's why you needed a phone, to be able to talk to somebody. Now you can do everything on your phone.
Okay.
You know, lighting has that similar capabilities.
Okay, so we're not all going to sit around and agree with each other.
Okay, so okay. I'll throw something out.
Okay, throw something
out. But that phone that you used to phone somebody, and that's all you could do, is phone something. That phone lasted 20, 30 years. Mm. Now our cell phones are lasting maybe 2 years I have my own personal opinions on downloading upgrades that kill your battery, but that's my own my own opinion. So if you have a phone that lasts 2 years, you're lucky now. And
are you suggesting that the electronics companies are sending you upgrades that actually are implanting in obsolescence into your device, Tom? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I'm gonna say no. That's not what I said at all. If you inferred that, I can't.
But here's back to lighting and lighting controls and all that. You know, so you're talking about tunability, which I think is the most. So we had Mariana Figuero from the Lighting mm-hmm. Research Center on the last episode. And it hasn't come out yet. It's going to be out in a week or week before yours. And they were talking about the health effects of lighting. And I think that tunability I think most people look at the tuning of lighting as fundamental to being able to provide a health system that actually can cause you to be healthier. Like not correlated.
Right. And but that is the door. That's the open door to the general public. That is the key. Like when you talk about somebody's health, it's wow, that's a gimme. That's why we all make sure that our office furniture is excellent, because the office furniture, people started talking about the ergonomic design of your chair so that your back doesn't get all cramped up or with 8 hours or whatever of sitting. So that's the end. I mean, and that's the most important aspect of tuning LEDs. There's no doubt about it. The most important aspect is the aspect of health. However, when we get into the cosmetics of it, that we can change what a space feels like, we can augment it so that it looks outstanding compared to anything else. It looks unique. There is a consumer aspect to that.
I think that's what Greg's always talking about with the changing out of the fixtures. I think that the point at which, Greg, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you've brought up a couple times on the shows, when do we stop retrofitting? When do we stop putting bulbs in? When do we start taking out fixtures? I think we start taking out fixtures when we have self-commissioning tunable lighting that automatically sets itself to some standard that is good for the general population based on your circadian rhythm in the Northern Hemisphere, say. And you put a date into it, it knows what date it is. It automatically knows when the daylight savings time comes in and it tunes itself through the day. I think that's the point at which you go to your customers and you say, look, I know in the past people have talked about the health effects of lighting and they've been, you know, most of them have been charlatans, quite frankly, in my opinion. Okay. I'm not talking about now, but I'm talking now that, you know, people are researching this. The Lighting Research Center is researching this. We're going to have causational data that says this helps people. And when we have that, I think that's when you start changing out those fixtures, Greg, and you say to people, look, this works. It's we enter a date at the top of the fixture, and now the fixture starts off with a blast of 5,000 K light in the morning for everybody. It's a little bit brighter. I don't know what it would be that would be healthy. I think that's the point, Greg. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what makes sense to me. It has to have some reason to do it other than because energy savings won't be there. So it's going to have to be something like that.
Like you go to a factory manager and you say, look, your night staff is hurting, bro. They're sleeping all day. They're up all night. You can help them if you put in a system that is circadian rhythm friendly or whatever it is. And here's how it works. It does this tell me when your shifts start, and we'll program this luminaire, maybe remotely,
to tune itself to give them optimal colors and amounts of light based on the time of day, based on natural light that's coming in and everything else. I think that's when you change the light fixture, Greg.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I agree. I think that makes sense.
What do you think, Tom?
One thing I want to...
Oh, go ahead, Greg.
Well, I'm going to change subjects a little unless Tom wants to chime in.
I want Tom to comment on that. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the aspect of shift workers' health can easily be rectified and not putting a dime in any of our pockets.
We don't want to hear about that.
I know. Okay, so I won't say anything. but in all trueness, I mean, good light is important, but good darkness is equally absolutely critical. So those individuals that are working at night, the best way to help their circadian rhythms, and this is again in my, like, I'm not a doctor, in my opinion, is to ensure that when they're sleeping that they have blackout drapes, and if they have you have like a blindfold type of apparatus so that no light gets in, you can get those blindfolds anywhere. Sometimes they come with a whip, and that's very functional for sleeping.
All right. So my question was on so I was looking at your strategic partnerships on the website and researching Lightfair. So I know you guys are part owner of Lightfair. Was it Lightfair idea from IES? Did it all come from you guys?
Well, this is, I certainly don't know exactly how it came about, but my understanding is that Lightfair was originally from the New York IES section.
Okay.
At one point in its history, it was purchased by the IES head office, and then the IES looked for assistance in running it, and the ownership, as it is now, three-headed ownership is now in place.
And again, is it an equal ownership between the three?
You'd have to ask.
Who are the other two players?
Lightfair itself and the IALD, International Association of Lighting Designers.
Is it a for-profit organization, Lightfair?
I'm not sure if you can consider it for-profit.
It would have a legal status. It would be either
true. You know, yeah, and again, you're asking someone who really doesn't.
Yeah, that's
know
okay. That. Yeah, your education. So we're just grilling you here.
You can grill me all you want. I hope we can take that out in editing.
Yeah, we can edit stuff. I mean, I don't think there's anything so far that needs to be cut out.
Just
I haven't dropped any swear words yet or anything like that. I haven't got too excited, eh, Greg?
Yeah.
So
now you've been good.
Yeah, so I've been doing good. So back to you, Greg. You got those questions lined up. Yeah. I'm sitting here in studio. I've never done an in studio one before, so go.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So I guess on Lightfair, and maybe you don't know the answer to it, but is that a big portion of IES revenue, or is it more from membership dues and other educational programs?
I don't know how large it is as a percentage. There is a certain percentage that it assists financially. Absolutely.
Sure. Okay. Capital. And then as far as formal alliances, strategic partnerships, supportive partnerships. What do all those mean?
You had Mark Lean on here. You should have been been grilling Mark on that. Yeah. That's all. That's a total. That's our advocacy plan and our industry relations. So, Alex Baker and Mark Lean.
Okay, yeah, I got an education question.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, the number one, and this is my opinion, the number one driver of the adoption of LEDs has ceased to be energy efficiency now, and is now low price. Okay, I think. You know, people go into Home Depot and they see three LED bulbs for $9 and there's a coupon and, you know, an $8 in Ontario. We had the IESO, Independent Electricity System Operator, handing out $8 on a rebate, instant rebate for three packs of LEDs. So people were selling them for $9. And so people would buy three light bulbs for $1, three LED light bulbs. So I think that the adoption of LEDs is being driven by price now. And you walked in my counter there. You saw some of the prices of the products. How do we change the consumer's view on that from being so price oriented to changing it to maybe a value sell? When Dr. Wilkins came on, he said, all light bulbs should be IEEE 1789 compliant, and that's what we need. A lot of that stuff is jargon to consumers, right? You have Energy Star, okay. Energy Star is pretty easy to get. Every light bulb in my showroom has Energy Star, whether it's
however, how many ever hours it lasts or whatever. They're all Energy Star. And anyone from Energy Star that wants to come on the show can come on and tell me, you know, why it's a great thing. What do we need to really guide the consumers, to guide the end users? What do we, how do we educate them? What do we do?
Well, that's a great question. The issue is, and this is my own personal opinion, again, it has nothing to do with the IES. I think manufacturers have enjoyed the fact that we had a population of consumers that, that didn't ask too many questions. So that's why we, rather than have bulbs or lamps marked with their correlated color temperature, we see daylight or warm light. I used to work for a manufacturer for many years. And
which one?
Philips, as a matter of fact. And I would ask the marketing people, why can't we just give it 3200 or what have you? And most of the time, the opinion that I got from the specific individual, and not Philips directly, was the fact that we don't want to complicate the matter in the consumer's eyes. Mm-hmm. So that's why you have this daylight lamp and you've got this warm light.
And that's cool white.
Yeah, and that's it. That's all you get, right? So cool light. So I think we need to educate the population on what it is for lighting. In the article, Greg, that you you read, I made mention of a very real and lasting experience that I had when I was giving a seminar across Canada, and I was describing how light sources generate light. Different sources are generating light. This award-winning interior designer stands up and says, "We all know what 50 watts of light looks like." And to the general population, watts was light.
Yeah, they're talking about incandescent light bulbs.
Yeah, or even sure. Even MR16s, right? The mm-hmm. Halogen lights, and even fluorescent that they were discussed. But that's the key. Now it's not even watts that's different anymore. We can't even say daylight. Daylight doesn't give you enough information.
It doesn't mean anything.
Warm light doesn't give you enough information. So we need to have a better educated consumer.
Well, here's what I would say. The problem you're going to have is, like, let's say you wanted to increase the amount of levels of sweetness and bitterness, and you, instead of calling it sweet or bitter, you called it flavor number 3725. Right? So what does that mean? Oh, it means it's 90% sweet with 10% bitterness.
It means I need a little bit more education on
right,
sweetness
and
bitterness.
I think people are bombarded with information right now. And I think that's why, you know, I think a lot of manufacturers are going back to those traditional lighting labels because people know what they're going to get. You know, if you, I mean.
But may I stop you there? Because
I think lighting people are confused by Kelvin temperatures.
I don't doubt that for a moment. But you don't get what you get. 5,000 Kelvin or 30 or 3,000 Kelvin lamp from one manufacturer is totally different than from the other one. You put them side by side, there is a noticeable
for sure.
difference. And it's even greater now because of the ability to manipulate the way an LED produces light so that the difference is much greater than it's ever
so
been.
So you're telling
before.
Me there's two different colors of 3,000 Kelvin?
No, there's more than that. Way more than that. There's way more than
well,
that.
Guess what? The host of the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast didn't know that. So how are we going to get these consumers to figure it out? Come on,
well,
man.
Well, it's in its infancy, as I mentioned. We've done.
So let me hang on a second here. Okay. So you have, I remember back you'd put a Philips 3500 KT8 beside a GE 3500 KT8. There'd be a slight difference maybe between them, right?
Yeah, one's a little pinker and the one's
a little
little greener.
Sure. And there'd be like tolerances and stuff. And what it was one was 3150 and the other was 3210 or something like that.
Not necessarily.
Okay, but hang on to my point for a second here. Now you have a Kelvin scale, which basically you're saying is not accurately displaying the color of the lamp. Like the Kelvin scale is ineffectual in its ability to pass on what the color of the experience, the color of the light that the consumer is going to get.
The Kelvin temperature will put you in the ballpark.
See, I don't even think most lighting people know that. Did you know that, Greg?
Yeah, well, that color binning that LED does. So the binning basically means it's a range of Kelvin temperatures. Is that kind of where you're getting at, Tom?
Yes, but even now, I mean, you can still have, as I mentioned, you can fine tune LED products now, so that you can have a 3200, but it really brings out the like the wicked blue.
You were saying shirt. That, yeah. So what measurement criteria is the lighting industry using to indicate this?
Well, there's nothing to be used now. They're going through a lot of different metrics in order to try to ascertain it, but it's tricky. It's a moving target right now. Kelvin temperature puts us in the right.
Hang on one second. We're just going to do this. You just blew my mind. So we don't have as an industry, we don't have a metric to properly measure the color potential of the LED products we're creating.
Okay, I will stop you there and say that is not entirely so, but it depends on how accurate you wish to be.
I want to be as accurate as possible.
Then we don't have that. We're working on multitudes of metrics in order to try to narrow down that.
Okay. But do you guys have a committee at the IES working on this right now?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, how far along are they?
It's right in its infancy. We announced the Globes initiative at the last annual conference, and there's people working in standards all the time.
Because the answer has to come from you guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's don't get me wrong. I don't want me.
I'm pointing my finger at
that's
you.
Okay.
Watch you on YouTube, folks. Get a grip on lighting. I'm pointing at Tom.
Please note, there are four fingers pointing back
there
at
you
Michael.
Go.
We're in the ballpark. We're okay. In the ballpark. It's not. I'm not saying you should dismiss color temperature because it will put
move
you
a little right, closer to your mic.
Yeah. It will put you in the right ballpark. But depending on how accurate you want to be, you need a two part metric. There's a lot of.
So was it always this way? Or is it, and just LEDs are making the contrast so stark, now we have to do something?
Exactly. It's always been this way, but the deviation has been such that we could let it go. You mentioned the GE and Philips lamp, and you add an Osram Sylvania lamp in there, and they're all 3500 Kelvin. They're gonna be slightly different. Mm. One's gonna be a little orange, one's gonna be pink, and one's gonna be green.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because the mix, in order to get to that average, it's not really an average, but to get to that color temperature, the mix can be different. I can get here from where I live from a variety of different routes.
Sure.
Right. I have to go to Northern Scarborough. I have to go to Northern Scarborough in order to get here. Mm-hmm. And I can come by a multitude of routes.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a little different. It'll take a little bit of different time.
So, but they're not ending up at the same place.
They're ending up
in the same parking lot.
Yeah.
Okay. But why does this matter?
I just think I think it's important for people to know so that they're able to ask.
Important
the right
for
question.
Who to know? Consumers or lighting guys?
Oh, I think lighting guys really need to know. Lighting guys need to know, and all good lighting guys know how important it is. And I think as it progresses, as lighting progresses, the industry progresses, and it becomes more. Like you talk about it, that it's ubiquitous and nobody cares, and nobody necessarily even
it's
is
an
aware
accessory
of it.
Is what it's
yeah.
Said. Yeah.
So I think people are going to become more and more noticeable of it, and it's going to become more important. Now will everybody need the exact?
See, I think good lighting is unnoticeable. How's that?
Yes. I mean, I'll just answer that question by saying yes. Good. You notice bad lighting much greater than you'd notice good lighting. However, if you're looking for it, there's good lighting and there's amazing lighting,
mm-hmm.
and you would notice amazing lighting if you're tuned to what you need to want.
That's also site that like application specific. So amazing lighting in a factory isn't amazing lighting in a restaurant, right? So.
Correct.
Right, so amazing. Like I know when I go around who's got a good lighting system and who doesn't. And, you know, but I just, Greg, do you have any, like, is your mind blown here or is it just me with this whole color temperature thing?
Well, I know there's that new standard coming out. I don't know much about it, but I haven't really put too much thought or effort into it at this point until we kind of get that clarified. So I don't know if my mind is blown because I know it's all new, but yeah, it's an interesting topic and something to really to be aware
of. You know, what from my perspective, it's when I think about it, whenever I think about anything in lighting, I think, does this matter when I sell? That's how I think. Mm-hmm. If someone says to me, oh, we need to consider the health effects of lighting. Okay, give me some causational proof of what works. Because I stand in front of the end user customer, mm-hmm. and I'm telling someone who's going to buy from me a transaction, mm-hmm. from me to them, they're going to use the lights and be under them and dim them and do whatever they're going to do. So it's very important to me that I'm not, you know, selling them any snake oil, right? So when this stuff comes up, I think to myself, okay, can I charge more for it? Can I offer it in some way that will make, you know, Atlas Lighting stand out amongst its competitors? I can't even begin to think about this different color temperature thing and how, tell me how an end user consumer, so you're like, this is me, okay, let's say you go to a high-end male clothing retailer and you say, hey, I got something for you. If you change out these light fixtures, we're changing light fixtures, Greg. Greg's yep. happy. He wants to change light good. Fixtures. So if you change your light fixtures, you can actually tune them based on different things. And if you want to show off a new line of, you know, blue suits you're bringing in or something like that, it can help. What other applications are there for this color temperature, this intense, deep control of color temperature? What other applications are there, Tom?
Well, the retail is a huge one. And you don't even have to go any further than a changing room. If you go into a changing room, and this is not new science, this has been around, this color temperature changing has been around for years, and I'll explain why in a second. When you go into a changing room, there's a lot of places where that the lighting there is the worst.
In Agreed, the
whole,
yeah.
And it should be the best, because that is where individuals make their final decision on whether they're going to use it or not. In my opinion, all retails of a certain level and up should have a very simple control system on the wall where you hit night and the lights will dim down to a very rich 2500 or 2200 dimmed incandescent, daylight, office, etc. And this stuff has been around for years in women's makeup mirrors or people's makeup mirrors. And they've had the little controls, and what all that's doing is it's hitting 2200, 2700, 4100, 6500, and it's changing the effect.
But you know what the thing is? I think you need to name it better, right? I think Kelvin, like if you're going to talk to my wife, goes into a change room, she's not going to call me on the cell phone. What the hell is 3200 Kelvin?
Well, no, you know what that.
I need to know.
But that is why, it, like in the makeup mirrors, it didn't say those things. It said
daylight,
what dining, home, office, outside.
That's a good idea.
That's a good application.
And you can fine tune anything. The whole aspect with the color is not that it's not. It's just that we're able to do so much more. That the metric itself, the CCT metric itself, in my opinion, this is strictly my opinion, this is not the IS's opinion, is that it's not good enough on its own. We need to part metrics.
We need to make it more complicated.
We can make it more exact.
Okay, so you said we can do so much more, okay? Mm-hmm. How do we start doing more? Like when do we, like who's on, so you are familiar with a lot of the manufacturer members of the IES, I would assume?
Most certainly.
Okay, who's on the forefront of this technology?
Oh, any of the big names are working on this right now. Any of the big names.
Who are the big names in lighting now? Tell me them.
They're the same as they've always
no
been.
No way, no way.
Well, the biggest name in lighting is the IES.
But okay, well, that's disputable. I thought it was the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast, personally.
No, but they're second, but they're number two with a bullet.
Okay. Right? No, but yeah. So who, that's a, I'm going to ask you, who are the big names in lighting right now, the biggest? Philips, I would say yes.
All right. There's a multitude of them. I don't really.
Oh, he doesn't want to do it, eh? Oh, we got him cornered now. Yeah. So, but we've talked a little bit about how the big three have ceded some ground.
Absolutely. Oh, at least a couple of them.
Yeah. Yes. And you can see it on Edison Report every day when mm-hmm. if you want to go to edisonreport.net. Great site for lighting.
Absolutely.
So, holy macaroni, that's a podcast right there. That's an hour. People get that pissed off because we go so long, but this is a great conversation, Tom. Greg, you have anything else for Tom?
I don't think so. No, I appreciate the time.
You know, Tom, nice we appreciate you coming on. Oh. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
It's first in studio guest. Tom, is there anything that you'd like to talk about with respect to the IES right now? You talked about your webinar series that came out. Where can people find the webinars? Can non-IES members access the webinar series?
Absolutely.
Okay. Where can they find it?
They can find it on IES, www.ies.org.
IES.org, yeah.
And, or that you can, anyone, any of your listeners, and I might regret this, they're welcome to email me at tbutters, B-U-T-T-E-R-S, at IES.org, and just put webinars, whatever in the heading, or Get a Grip podcast in the heading, and, sure, and I'll get to it.
Okay.
And I'll help them out.
How else can, you know, let's say somebody's starting out in the business, they, you know, they just got a job and they're listening to this podcast and they want to learn more and they really should join Nailed and they should take LS1 and then LS2, which, you know, we're not competitors, but we have a good educational offering at Nailed as well. Mm-hmm. Where should they, how should they interact with IES? Let's say their boss doesn't give them a budget for memberships. How can they interact with the IES as an individual if they want to come up in the business a little bit?
Well, the free webinars are, sure, are one. We have a number of programs and we're increasing them all the time at, on our website. So I invite them to climb on our website, go to the education tab, go down to electronic resources, and we're building. When I first came on board, we didn't have a lot of content. So it's very tough to go to someone and say, hey, as we started this conversation, hey, we're the IES, you know who we are, we've been around for 100 years. Well, what can you give me? Well, we're the IES. Hey,
we've been around for 100 years.
Yeah, so I mean,
sounds like Nailed sales pitch, eh, Greg? No,
but hey. But I mean, I'm only speaking from an educational standpoint, not standards. I mean, we're the ANSI standards organization.
So I'm going to go back to this. So most, so Greg's an LC. I'm not. I don't like to take tests. I like to do podcasts.
Well, that's it. If you don't like to do tests, then that's a test.
I'm not
you
a test guy. Do. I don't know about tests, right. But here. So most of the people in members of Nailed would become an LC. They would take LS1 and then LS2, and then they would go challenge the LC exam and take some of those courses or whatever. How would somebody, what's the best, the most convenient path to become an LC? With the that you can describe just for the listeners that are out there interested that don't want to join Nailed, but yes, what's another path?
It is a hard exam.
So you can anyone just go challenge the exam?
Sure, if you don't want to pass.
Okay, no, but hang on. Like you need 10 years experience. What do you need to
qualify to take the exam? They suggest 5 years experience, and
it's a suggestion. So anyone can go challenge it.
If you're under five, you have to have some people, and the LC exam is NCQLP. It's not necessarily the IES. But I would strongly recommend taking as many lighting courses as you can. The LC exam is administered the first Saturday of November every year. I would start in June and look at the suggested reading, and it's substantial. And if you pile the books up on this table, it'd probably be 3.5 feet high.
Oh my goodness.
So I would suggest starting at that point. Ask people. That's the most incredible eye-opening part of me being on in the IES. I ask, all of our material is done by our members for our members. It's all done in a volunteer basis. And the members in the IES are so giving of their time. So if that's what I would recommend. Start sometime in June with the reading. Speak to somebody, speak to an LC, speak to a member in the IES. Ask their opinion. They are so giving of their time. It's absolutely incredible.
Can I ask, sorry, I know we're dragging on. We often go to end a podcast and then I get going again on something, but does the LC, is it complemented by like energy manager and energy management and verification professional qualifications? Those compliments, are they competitors to the LC?
I think they're just a totally separate.
They're just compliments. They're compliment education. Okay. All right. Well, you know, Tom, I'm going to say thank you very much for coming on the Get a Grip on Lending podcast, especially coming in studio, my first in studio guest. And yeah, just to all you American listeners out there, we're still taking over. You don't know it, but you know, most Canadians are kind of like Midwesterners, but they got knives behind their back. Eh? That's what most people don't realize about us.
And we play hockey.
Yeah. And so there you go. Thank you for coming on the show, Tom. Appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Keystone Technologies. Come on, sign hero. Visit KeystoneTech.com. You know the words. KeystoneTech.com, baby. KeystoneTech.com. Check out those sign heroes. You know what I'm talking about. Chop all the wires on one side of the sign, chop all the wires on the other side of the sign, bring one to the live, the other to the neutral. Slam those Sign Hero 360 degree rotatable socket LED T12 and T8 HO replacements into the sign, man. Keystone's got all the sizes. Come on, man. What's left out there? Just signs, man. Signs. That's why you got to go Sign Hero from Keystone Technologies. KeystoneETech.com. And don't forget that this is the unofficial podcast of the lighting business, but it's the official podcast of the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Remember, we were first. Get a Grip on Lighting was the first serious lighting podcast. Visit NAILD.org. It was brought to you by the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. That's NAILD.org, man. Get some education. Join the association. We have a new membership category called Associate Member. That means if you don't have a warehouse, if you don't have a warehouse full of light bulbs like I do, you can still join Nailed. What? Yeah, man. That gets you all kinds of discounts and free webinars and all sorts of stuff. So visit NAILD.org for information, for joining the association, to check out our events, and to click on our podcast. But you can just go to getagriponlighting.com too. And thanks to Tom Butters. Thanks, Tom, for coming on the show. The IES is bringing a goal. There's so much education. So much learning needs to happen right now in the lighting business. And Tom Butters has really come up big with a huge menu of different training that the IES is putting out. All kinds of different things. They're putting out a podcast. They're putting out the lights of the round. They're putting out a bunch of webinars. Some of the stuff's for members, some of the stuff's for non-members. So check out IES.org and Tom Butters. You can also go to the getagriponlighting.com website, and you're going to see a bunch of links to the IES. Website links there, the social pages, LinkedIn, they got it all. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. The IES is balling on that for sure. They got all the different social stuff. So thanks, Tom, for coming on the show and telling us about the IES and having a great conversation with us. And other than that, peace. Get a Grip on Lighting, episode 17.